Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. That means you can go over to 1517.org/podcast and see if there's anything new there. If you haven't been there before, there's a whole bunch of stuff you don't know about. If you haven't been there recently, there may be some things that you don't know about because things get added on a pretty regular basis. There's like 12, 13 podcasts there now. So you should go over there, check it out, see if there's anything that you would like to listen to. I'm sure there is. Chad, we're in Advent. Christmas is coming, but here we are in Numbers.
The most Christmassy book in the Bible.
We're still counting.
It's kind of funny. In chapter 17, which is the chapter we're almost to, there's a strange Christmassy feel to this when you kind of look at this verse and the way it was used in the Middle Ages. I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead, but we're gonna put our toe into a little bit of the nativity when we get to chapter 17.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. Yeah. There's a little foretaste of what is to come.
That's good. My nativity set is up.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't even tell you. We have not decorated one bit. No tree up, no decorations, nothing. We've been, it's still in the attic. I got to climb the ladder, get it down.
And we're recording this on a Monday, which means it probably not going to happen until the weekend, right? It sounds like a weekend job.
It's definitely a weekend job. Yeah. So I can just always say, well, you know, we're observing Advent, not Christmas.
That's true. You could be one of those sticklers. You could be Christmas doesn't actually start till the 25th, and then it goes straight into January.
I'll hide my laziness behind the veil of piety.
Yeah, you just hide it behind the church calendar. It's good. Right.
Yeah, we are. We're full swing into Advent, and Christmas is coming up. And I think, is it next week we're recording our combined 30 minutes in the New Testament?
I believe so. We're gonna, that'll be coming out as tradition has it, man. We'll be back with some Old Testament Christmas stuff.
Awesome, be fun. Well, we left off last time, kind of in the middle of a mess, and so we're gonna have to kind of pick up with that today. I think maybe toward the end of the last episode, we talked about how you would assume. That after all of the terrible things that happened after Korah's rebellion, that Israel would just like zip their lips and toe the line for quite a while, seeing the aftermath of Korah's rebellion. But as we shall see in chapter 16, verse 41 and following, such is not the case. So just to recap last time, most of chapter 16 of Numbers was consumed by Korah's rebellion, along with a couple of other guys named Dathan and Avaram, who were of the tribe of Levi. They were of the tribe of Reuben, and Korah was of the tribe of Levi. And we kind of had some intertribal squabbling going on, like who says that Aaron is the only one who can be in the priesthood? What about all these other Levites? And then with Dathan and Avaram, we had kind of the old Reuben tribe coming back. And he was the firstborn of Jacob. If you can remember way back in Genesis, he's the one who slept with his father's co-wife or concubine. And thus he got booted from the blessing of the firstborn. And so you kind of pick up maybe in Dathan and Avaram this lingering feeling that, hey, we should really be the ones who's leading Israel, not Moses and Aaron, who are from the tribe of Levi, who's not anywhere close to being the firstborn. So whatever the motivations were, it was an effort to see who was top dog, who was in control, who's going to pull the strings, you know, who has all of the power in the leadership of Israel. And that didn't go so well, because ended up about 250 guys were barbecued by the fire that came forth from the Lord, and the earth swallowed up the others. So it was not a bright and cheery day in Israel's history. So all that happened, that takes us through verse 40. Verse 41 starts out with the phrase, but on the next day. So all this happens, and you can just kind of imagine the mood in the camp. You mean anytime you have any kind of traumatic event happen, you've got a lot of PTSD or something like that that happens. It's impossible for something this big not to affect people psychologically. But here's what happens. On the next day, all the congregation, the sons of Israel, grumbled against Moses and Aaron. So this is, we're picking up the same thing once more, except this is kind of an interesting twist. So they've grumbled a lot, but look what their grumbling consists of this time. They say, you are the ones, are talking to Moses and Aaron. You, Moses and Aaron, are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. Now, what's interesting about that is because they are, as it were, claiming that, and this is contrary to everything that just happened, but they're still claiming that those who died were on the Lord's side, which makes absolutely no sense. I mean, this was just about as evident can be, that the Lord chose those who were his, and the guys that died were not on his side. But this is what the Israelites say. You, Moses and Aaron, are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. So this is, you know, this is kind of the classic game shifting blame that's been played over and over throughout the scriptures, and of course continues being played today. But Moses and Aaron, they're the ones who obviously are guilty in the eyes of these people. And not only that, but they've caused not just the death of people, but the Lord's people. So in a strange twist, all of a sudden, Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and the 250 other guys who rebelled against Moses and Aaron, now all of a sudden, they were the Lord's people.
Yeah, and it seems like there's an element of, even if they were to say, okay, yeah, there was some, you know, these people, there was this rebellion, and then this happened, and there was this golden calf thing, and that other thing happened. But ultimately, this is all your fault, because you are the one who said, let my people go. You are the one that brought us out here. So everything that happens out here, even if it's other people rising up and doing crazy things, that really goes back to being your fault, because you're the one that brought us out here. So At the end of the day, you're the one. So this is on you. And then on top of that, in this specific event, it's like they don't realize that Moses can't make the ground open up and eat people for lunch. That's not something Moses has a power to. Like, as if Moses knew, like, well, there's going to be an earthquake kind of thing right over there. I'll just have them go stand over there.
Yeah, this is one of those instances that is far, far from rare, where it just amazes me the capacity of humanity in the face of their obvious guilt to still deny it.
Yeah,
everything around screams that you're guilty, and they say, no, it's somebody else's fault.
Yeah, this is a very Adam move. What Adam does, you know, like when after the fall, or as Nestigan says, the reach, what Adam does, he says, he doesn't actually just simply blame Eve. Should be one thing to do, like, well, man, she picked it, and then, like, you know, she ate, and then I love her so much that, you know, I ate too. It wasn't just like that. He says it was the woman that you gave me. So what he does is he actually blames God. He could just own it and be like, yeah, it's my fault, this is our fault, either one of work, like, mine or us, it was me, whatever. No, so he's like, well, I mean, when you trace it all the way back, it's actually your fault, because you're the one that, like, put her here. And so they're doing this with Moses, where they're like, actually, your fault, because you're the one who brought them here. And then they rose up in rebellion, but you're the one that brought them here. You were the one that put the things in motion that got us to this point. This is a very old Adam kind of thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, figure out how you can draw a line the furthest from you, and then rest all the blame there.
Yeah.
I know
yeah.
It looks like it's like this, but really, if you think about it, it's this.
Yeah, sort of self-justification by the claim of victimhood, right?
Yeah.
We're just the victims here of the saving deeds of Moses and Aaron that Yahweh brought about through them. We're the victim of all of these acts of redemption by which God has freed us from slavery and brought us through the wilderness.
Yeah, this is the, if you hadn't saved us, this never would have happened. Yeah. Much like Adam, if you hadn't created us, this never would have happened.
Yeah.
Some crazy logic.
It is. And so you can see, based upon the attitude of the Israelites, why God reacts the way he does to this. So following, that's just all in one in verse 41. So it says that what happened afterward, that when the congregation assembled against Moses and Aaron, they all of a sudden they looked toward the tent of meeting, and the glory cloud of Yahweh appears, and Moses and Aaron, they go toward the tabernacle, and God speaks to Moses, and he more or less says, hey, get out of the way. I'm going to destroy them right now. That's almost literally what he says. Get away from this congregation that I may consume them instantly. And actually, that's pretty much what he said earlier in the chapter, back in verse 21. This is after Korah and his group assembled against Moses and Aaron. It says there in verse 21 that God is speaking to Moses again and says, separate yourselves from this congregation that I may consume them instantly. So on that occasion, Moses responded by falling on his face and praying that God would not do that. He said, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation? So he's kind of making his, the typical Mosaic argument that based upon God's name and character, he cannot act this way, because to act this way would be unjust. Now, in this particular case, Moses doesn't respond that way, for one, because in this case, it's like all the congregation is there. It's not like there's 250 people. It's not there's like Korah and a few others who are rebelling. It says the whole congregation is assembled against Moses and Aaron. So Moses doesn't respond by appealing to God to have mercy or to act justly and not kill the innocent with the guilty. Instead, this time he responds with prayer again, but a different kind of prayer. In verse 21, he responds to God with a verbal prayer. And here, after verse 45, he's going to respond with what you might call a ritualized prayer, because what he's going to use is incense. And if you remember from our discussions in Exodus and Leviticus, incense is the visual embodiment of prayer. That's why we have an altar of incense in front of the curtain in the holy place, because as the incense is burned, then the prayers are offered up. And as the incense arises toward the heavens, so our prayers arise toward God. And so there's incense has always been this visual embodiment, or you almost call it an icon of prayer. So that's the same way that Moses is going to respond here. He's going to respond with prayer, but a different kind of prayer. He's going to respond with the prayer of incense. So he doesn't even speak to God. He speaks directly to his brother Aaron. He says, take your censer and get some fire on it from the altar and put some incense on it, and then take it out and hurry up to the congregation and make atonement for them, because wrath has gone forth from the Lord and the plague has begun. So we don't really know what form this plague took, but evidently it was already happening and people were dropping like flies around the congregation. So Aaron followed. Aaron, in this case, did exactly what his brother Moses told him to do. In fact, I think you could probably title, you have little headings in your Bible for the various sections. You could probably title this one, The Only Time the High Priest Ran. I think this is the only recorded instance where Aaron actually hurried up and did something. He says, verse 47, Aaron took it as Moses had spoken, and he ran into the midst of the assembly. And so you kind of picture this. It's kind of a strange scene. People are dropping like flies because of the plague, and Moses is telling Aaron what to do and to hurry up. And so Aaron grabs a censer, puts fire on it, puts incense on it, and he is running out into the midst of the congregation. And it says, verse 48, that Aaron took his stand between the dead and the living so that the plague was checked. And verse 49 says that this was happening quickly because those who died by the plague were 14,700. So this was not like, oh, a dozen people died from the plague. This was a major event. And I was reading this morning and thinking, Aaron in some way maybe regains a little bit of his lost reputation from the golden calf episode, because in this case, he actually saves people's lives and hurries up and actually does what needs to be done in order to stand. I mean, he stands right there between the dead and the living while the plague is going on, and as a result of the incense that he offers, it acts like a buffer or a wall so that the plague is stopped by the incense.
This is a pretty heroic move.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, they're like, all right, dude, the plague is going on. Get out there in the midst of it. And you're like, I don't know, man.
He's like running. So you got these two, imagine if you're at war and you got these two battle fronts, and you know, there's like the no man's zone between them, and he runs right out there in the middle of it. You know, he's got his incense, he's swinging his censer around, the incense is going everywhere. So yeah, that took some courage.
Yeah, because you don't know that you're not just gonna get taken out by this plague.
right, yeah.
I mean, I suppose you believe that God's not angry with you and that he's not going to, but still, like, maybe he's about to get angry with you for running out there in the middle of it.
Yeah, you know, that's true. You know, and I think if there's one episode in Aaron's life where he most closely serves as sort of a foreshadowing of the Messiah, other than his high priestly duties, it's probably here. And I mean, there's this man who is running right into the midst of death and destruction. And as a result of his intercession and mediation, if you will, the wrath is stopped, the plague is stayed. And of course, he himself isn't harmed, but his action kind of has this messianic overtone to it, because here's this chosen man of God who runs right into the fray, into the midst of death and destruction and wrath. And as a result of that, the wrath is stopped and the plague is stopped. And a lot of people who would have been destroyed, their lives are saved. So
yeah, and it's not as though God, this is something that God said he should do. This is something Moses came up with this, right? I mean, so like Moses, think about this. I mean, this is Moses figuring out how to dam up the wrath of God against people. That's pretty nuts, man.
Yes, yeah, it is pretty nuts. Yeah, yeah. There's no recorded. It wasn't like God said to Moses, "Okay, I'll relent if you send your brother out there with incense." Just like Moses reacted. He's like, "Okay, Aaron, hurry, get your censer, go out there." Aaron takes off running, and it works. The plague is stayed. I mean, it's a great example of kind of this theological theme of the necessity of intercession, of the necessity of mediation, that there's only one way that wrath is going to be stopped. It's going to be by somebody standing between the dead and the living, somebody who does what needs to be done in order to stop the wrath of God. So,
well, you need a quote. I mean, in this sense, I mean, no, Aaron is not righteous in the same way that Christ is righteous, but in this instance, he is righteous in the sense that he is blameless in this thing. He's blameless in this grumbling and rebellion. He's not part of that. And so what you end up needing is a righteous intercessor. You need a righteous dam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Aaron is.
Yeah, so this is a great, great illustration of kind of the, I guess you could think of it as the high priestly role outside the tabernacle. Of course, this isn't taking place where most of the high priest duties take place. So he's taking his office outside of the precinct of the tabernacle to where the action is actually where it's at, and doing what needs to be done to make sure that the people are saved.
Yeah. So. Yep. Man, it is a pretty Christ-like move, man. You have a righteous man standing between sinners and the wrath of God. That's how it goes.
So that takes us through the end of chapter 16, and it might seem as if this took care of the situation, but there's one more thing we need to wrap up before this whole episode is done, and that's what we have in chapter 17. So. Begins with God speaking to Moses and him. So this, you know, this chain of command, if you will, or the way in which God communicates. He speaks to Moses, then Moses speaks to the congregation. So Moses is supposed to say to the sons of Israel that we're gonna have a little test here. So here's what the test is going to consist of. I want you to go to each of the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. And I want you to get a rod or a staff from each of the heads of these tribes. And I want you to write on that staff that particular person's name. So this is kind of a play on words here, because the Hebrew word for staff is mateh, but mateh is also the word for tribe. So depending on the context, to be translated either way. And the reason is because this was not just exclusively Israel's tradition, but this was a tradition of the Near East that when you had a leader, he often carried a staff, a special staff as a symbol, an outward symbol of who he was or who his people were. So this one just, in other words, this wasn't just like a walking stick or just a shepherd's crook. This particular staff had emblematic authority. So you can imagine that each of the heads of the tribes of Israel had their staff that was a symbol of their office. So they're to gather these 12, and each of them are going to have their name written on the staff. And on Aaron's rod, that is for the tribe of Aaron, for the tribe of Levi, rather, they were to write Aaron's name. So they gather up these 12 staffs, and they put them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony. Now, I don't know for sure if this was like literally inside the Holy of Holies, or maybe just in the holy place, right outside the curtain, but wherever it is, it's going into the tabernacle. So then God says, here's what's going to happen. It will come about that the rod of the man, or the staff of the man whom I choose, will sprout. Then he adds this: thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you. That verb for lessen, to decrease, is the same verb that's used way back in Genesis to describe how the waters of the flood go down. So it's just, it occurs in Esther too, for how like the wrath of King Ahasuerus was abated. So you can kind of picture these waters, they're at a high level and they begin to decrease, to abate, to go down.
So it's like a receding.
Yes, it's a receding. That's a good translation of this. So God says, thus I shall, you know, it's like the grumblings are going to recede. Like there's been this flood of all these grumblings, and now they're going to recede, because I'm about to show once and for all, so that there's absolutely no question about it after this point, the person whom I have chosen. So we'll see what happens. It says that Moses went to all the leaders and he told them what God said. And so they each gave him a staff, and they put those in front of the testimony, that is to say in front of the Holy of Holies. where the Ark of the Covenant was. And I guess, you know, they did this and then they waited till the next day to see what would happen. And they went in, I'm in verse 8, so they go in the next day, Moses does, and it says, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had not only sprouted, God said in verse 5 that it would sprout, okay? Because this is a dead piece of wood. This is not, you know, something you just pulled off of a tree. But not only did it sprout, but it put forth buds and blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. I mean, this is kind of a crazy image here. So you can kind of, you know, everybody's gathered around the tent of meeting, wondering, yeah, what's going to happen? Especially the leaders, you know, they gave the staffs the day before, and they're waiting to see what might happen. And here comes Moses walking out of the tabernacle, and he's got 11 staffs that look exactly like they did the day before. They're just a dried, dead piece of wood, and he's holding Aaron's staff, and not only does it have like flowers and buds and all of this, but it's like there's like almonds growing on it.
Yeah, it's like a little snack on this thing.
yeah. I mean, it's a wild image that overnight, out of death came forth life. Out just a lifeless, ugly stick. Now we have, it's just like, it's like a tree. It's become like an almond. The staff has turned into an almond tree. So contrary to everything that should happen according to the course of nature, and solely by the power of God's word, out of this dead stick came forth beauty and life. So I want to get back to that image here in a minute, but here's what happens. Verse 10, it says that, so everybody checks out the staffs. I mean, it's obvious that Aaron's staff is the one that has become a living tree. And God says to Moses, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take the rod of Aaron, and I want you to keep it before the testimony as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me so that they should not die. And so that's what Moses did. And so what they ended up doing is that the Ark of the Covenant, which contained the tablets of the covenant, the two tables of stone, and that also had the jar of manna, now the Ark of the Covenant also held the staff of Aaron that had sprouted blossoms and ripe almonds and all of that. So you can kind of this is really an intriguing inclusion in the tabernacle, because you remember earlier on in this chapter, or the previous chapter actually, after the rebels were killed, their incense, their censers were gathered up and melted down to make a bronze covering for the altar. So like, yeah, worked into the sanctuary itself was the leftovers of the rebellion. So you kind of have the same thing here, because the only reason that Aaron's staff and the other staffs were gathered together was because of the rebellious nature of the people and their grumblings. And so this remains as a remembrance of their grumblings, but also as a remembrance of the Lord's choice of the tribe of Levi. Now, I said at the beginning of the program that we were gonna just get a little bit into the nativity. Now, this is really a great example of the medieval mind, because in a lot of medieval art, and we have some of this actually earlier in the history of the church as well, but in a lot of medieval art and preaching, believe it or not, the staff of Aaron became the go-to story to talk about the conception and birth of Christ from the Virgin Mary. It's probably not the first thing that leaps into people's mind when they read this story, but there's a book that I've loved for years. It's called the Bible for the Poor. If you have to Google it sometime, read an article about it. But it's basically a series of woodcuts. And I can't remember when this came out, if it was the 13th or 15th century, but anyway, it was a medieval publication. And each page would follow the life of Christ, and in the center of each page would be a picture from the life of Christ. And then to the left and right of it would be images from the Old Testament, which are understood in one way to be an example or a type of whatever this particular event in the life of Christ was. And then it had Bible verses that went along with each page and with each picture. And in the page in the Bible for the poor that talks about the nativity, in the center is a picture of Mary giving birth to Christ. On the left side is a picture of Gideon and his fleece, which is talked about in the book of Judges. And on the right side, it's a picture of Aaron holding a censer. And that is the biblical reference is actually to his staff budding. Now, you might wonder, well, how in the world is this connected? Well, in the medieval mind, it works like this. Just as from this staff, which was not supposed to produce anything living, it was completely against the course of nature for this to happen. It happened only by the authoritative word of God, the creative word of God, that the staff brought forth blossoms, brought forth fruit. So also, it was completely contrary to nature for a virgin to conceive without male involvement and to bear a son. So that happened only by the word of the Father and the power of the Holy Spirit overshadowing the Virgin Mary. So it's an example of how for the medieval mind, Christian mind, when they're reading through the Old Testament, they're constantly reading it through the prism of the New. And we might not always agree with their exegesis, their interpretation, but they will do anything in order to see Christ all over the place. And they saw this particular story as an example of how God is able to bring forth, contrary to nature, life from that which should not produce life. So there you have it. There's your Christmas theme.
There it is. Not only do you have, so you have the obvious life where there shouldn't be life. But this is on the heels again. Like what sort of life does Mary bring forth? Well, the sort of life that stands between sinners and the wrath of God, right? I mean, so Aaron's staff budding is not disconnected from this thing that happened right before that. I mean, this whole episode is connected, right? So you do have life where there shouldn't be life, which obviously happens with Mary, and the life that she brings forth is that same kind of life, which is a high priest who stands between sinners and the wrath of God. And so it's all connected, man.
Yeah, it is. Sometimes I'll encounter folks who are troubled by what they see as sometimes it's called eisegesis, that is like reading into these Old Testament passages meanings that aren't there. And I understand that concern. But it's the reason that you'll have interpretations like that with Aaron's staff and the virgin birth is simply because, when your mind is saturated with the scriptures, when all these stories are understood to be interconnected by the person and the work of Christ, then it's really impossible not in some way to make these connections. And it's not like you read this and see it as a prophecy of the virgin birth, but you can see it as a narrative example of how God is embedding within these Old Testament narratives seeds, as it were, that will come to full blossom in the birth and the ministry of Christ. So,
well, you sort of have permission to do this too by Christ himself, who says that everything in the Old Testament is about him. I mean, he is the one who makes this claim, right? That the law, which that would be one of the books that we're in right now, the law, the prophets, the Psalms, they're all about, he says they're all about him. Yeah. So he's the one that first makes this claim. And then you see examples throughout the New Testament in the writings of Paul and others of them doing this sort of thing all over the place. I mean, you have things like that they were all, everyone was baptized into Moses and they all drank from the same rock and that rock was Christ. Well, that's not a connection that anyone would make. But that's what he says it is.
Yeah, I mean, in the New Testament itself, you have some pretty kind of crazy connections that are made. I mean, I would never have just thought to compare Jesus to Jonah. I mean, of all Old Testament people, right? Jonah, really? And then, of course, as we've talked before in this program about the bronze serpent, you don't really usually connect a serpent with Jesus, but that's what our Lord himself does. So it's kind of, it's in concert with all these other Old Testament stories and how they used in the New Testament to actually see this particular story as at least theologically, thematically connected to the Lord's work in his incarnation, nativity.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the craziest examples, that maybe something you would just never think about, is unless the New Testament brought it out. And I mean, Hebrews is maybe a go-to book for this sort of thing, right? You wouldn't think, oh yeah, Jesus definitely is a priest in the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is like a throwaway story if it doesn't come up again in the New Testament, where the author of Hebrews draws like a straight line and says like, oh no, these things are like the same.
Yeah, he's got like a whole chapter devoted to that. Yeah, I mean, the guy occurs in Genesis 14.
He's like a couple verses, man, and then it's done.
Yeah, yeah. He walks in. Yeah, Abraham gives him an offering. He provides bread and wine, and then he's gone. Yeah, until Psalm 110, then he pops up again. You're like, what? What priest in the order of Melchizedek? What is that? Yeah, and then Hebrews is like it's a huge deal. He occurs like, I don't know, at least all of chapter 7, and then three or four times elsewhere in the book. So yeah, I mean, sometimes something that seems really small, extraneous, not important, just maybe one or two verses in the Old Testament will just blow up in the New Testament. And, it's not exactly the same. We played around with this a couple episodes ago, but, you know, Adam doesn't come up very much in the Old Testament.
Right.
Genesis 3 is just the whole eating from the tree. I mean, that's just not, it just doesn't come up in the rest of the, I mean, there's a couple of allusions to it in the Old Testament, but it's not like a big deal. Yeah, but then you get to the New Testament, Adam's all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's almost like you needed the second Adam to realize how important the first Adam is, right?
Yeah. 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 I think that's what's going on. And another thing is, this would be too far afield to get into, but you know, you got to keep in mind too that, you know, what was going on in the culture, the Jewish culture and writings around that time, sometimes would influence the amount of the kind of material that was included in the New Testament. And I know from some other Jewish literature of the first century that there was a lot of talk about Adam. And I also know there was a lot of talk about Melchizedek in the first century. So sometimes that influences why authors bring in the particular stories that they do. But whatever the reason, what's going on when the New Testament writers grab these stories and expand on them is that they're doing exactly what Christ told us to do in his Emmaus conversation. We are reading Christ and his fullness out of the Old Testament, even if it's a two-verse story. He's still there in one way or another, winking at us, hinting at who he is to become and what he's to do for us.
That's it. That is pretty much what we, if you go all the way back to episode 1 of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, that is essentially what we promised to do. That was the whole reason behind it. That's what we've been trying to do for 140 something episodes that we've done, and that's what we'll continue to do. Guys, that's it. That's 40 minutes. Hey, if these 140 something episodes have been a benefit to you, you can become a supporter. That could help us out. You can go over to 1517.org, go to the support page, or Christ So Fast, you can go to the support page there. Every little bit helps. If you want to do that, that would be wonderful. And for those of you who have done that, we appreciate it very, very much. Also, did you know that there's still some tickets, not a lot of tickets, very few tickets, to Here We Still Stand 2019. Here's the thing, though. The ticket price does go up at the first of the year. So maybe it's a Christmas present that you need to buy yourself. Maybe it's a Christmas present you need to buy someone else. The ticket price goes up after the first of the year. You need to get on that early Chad Bird special ticket price that will be there through December 31st. Grab it. I don't think the tickets will be there much longer than that anyway, because there's only, I think we're about 75% or so sold out. So there's only about 25% of those tickets left, so you should grab them. That's it, Chad. We'll see you next week, man.
All right. See you then. Thanks.